TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. This week on the show, we're joined by staff writer Melissa Del Bosque. Welcome, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by Chris Scott, a Dallas man who spent 13 years in prison before law students from the University of Texas at Arlington convinced Dallas County District Attorney Craig Watkins to reopen the case. He was exonerated. Now he's returning the favor through an exoneree detective agency he's formed with two other Dallas exonerees. In February, Scott met with Alonzo Hardy, the man who actually did the crime that landed him in prison. But before we get to that, we've got another story to discuss. The Observer has partnered with The Guardian for a four-part series called Beyond the Border. Texas has become the deadliest state in the U.S. for undocumented immigrants. In 2012, 271 migrants died while crossing through Texas, surpassing Arizona as the nation's most dangerous entry point. The majority of those deaths didn't occur at the Texas-Mexico border, but in rural Brooks County, 70 miles north of the Rio Grande, where the U.S. Border Patrol has a checkpoint. This series looks at the lives impacted by this humanitarian crisis. Here to help us talk about this is Melissa Del Bosque.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So, Melissa, just for starters, can you give us a gist of the series?
Sure, yeah. It's as you mentioned earlier, it's a four-part series. It's a multimedia series. There's video, graphics, and text. I'm doing the text portion of it. So there's a team of us working on this series, both at the Texas Observer and at The Guardian. And we had the first story come out on Wednesday, so we're going to release a story every Wednesday during the month of August. So it's coming out really well. I'm really looking forward to it.
We've got four stories total.
Yeah, four stories total. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have videos and graphics and things like that every week.
And each story focuses on a specific aspect or a specific person, but what is sort of the main thrust of the series?
Well, my goal with this series was really to put a human face back on the immigration issue. In 2012, we hit a historic record here in Texas, a very unfortunate record of being the deadliest state in the nation for undocumented immigrants. And more than half of those deaths are occurring in this rural county that's 70 miles north of the international border. So the folks in Brooks County, it's very rural, a lot of private ranches, not more than 7,000 people living in the whole county, are dealing firsthand on a daily basis with this sort of international humanitarian crisis, with, you know, hundreds of people coming through the county who are trying to get around this federal checkpoint that's 13 miles south of Falfurrias, which is the biggest city in the county, and a lot of people dying there every year. 2012 was the worst year because of the triple-digit heat that we had during the summer. That was a real, real bad year. They had 129 bodies recovered in the county. So that was the county with the highest number of migrant deaths in the whole country.
And so what are the factors that have pushed this part of Texas beyond even Arizona in terms of migrant deaths?
Well, there's been a real influx of people coming from Central America in the last two or three years. Interestingly enough, the rate of people from Mexico and people crossing the border is at an all-time low for the last 40 years. But at the same time, specifically in the Rio Grande Valley on the Texas border, we're having this huge increase of Central Americans coming. And that is due to various factors, mostly violence. Now Honduras has the highest homicide rate in the world, which to me is just nuts.
Right.
A lot of poverty. Honduras had a coup in 2009, and that really unleashed a lot of violence, which has only gotten worse. And so most of the people who are coming across are from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala.
So as you mentioned, this is a four-part series. The first story in the series has come out. It's called Into the Wilderness. It focuses very heavily on a woman named Exelina Hernandez. Can you tell us a little bit about her story?
Sure. I mean, one of my goals with this series was finding a family who could talk about losing a loved one in Brooks County, which is very difficult to find a family because sure. People are dealing with various levels of citizenship, and there's a lot of fear, so people don't want to talk about what they're going through. But after some searching, I found a family who lives in Irving, Texas, and the story, I focus on Elsie Hernandez, who's a 47-year-old woman from El Salvador, but she's lived in the United States now for almost 20 years, and her daughter, Exelina, who's a 31-year-old daughter, who she'd left behind in El Salvador when she came over to the U.S. To find a better life and to send money home to her two children. And so Exelina came in 2001 illegally to Texas and lived here for 10 years. She had two children. She married a U.S. citizen. Both of her children are U.S. citizens. And she decided she wanted to become a legal resident. She wanted to fix her paperwork and do things the right way. So our immigration laws are very complicated. If you've right. come into the country undocumented, you have to go back to your home country and apply from there. But if you've been caught here illegally, and she was caught in 2001 by Border Patrol, then you're banned from coming back into the United States for at least 10 years or more. It's very difficult to get back in legally. So her family got an immigration attorney, and they filed the paperwork, and they did all those things. And then she decided to go back to El Salvador with her two children and apply from there and do everything the right way. But what had happened in the 10 years she had been gone living here in Texas, gang violence had really taken over San Salvador, the capital of the country where she was living. And the gang controlled the neighborhood where she was living and started extorting her for money. Otherwise, they were going to kidnap and kill her children. She had a 3-year-old and a 10-year-old. And so her family was paying this extortion every month, and it kept getting worse, and the money amounts that they wanted kept escalating. So finally, she decided she couldn't stay there.
Right. It wasn't worth the risk.
It wasn't worth the risk. She was worried her children would be killed. So her children went back. They're U.S. citizens. Their grandparents came and picked them up, and they flew back. You know, 4-hour flight from Dallas to San Salvador.
Sure.
But for her, she didn't have documents, so she had to come illegally. So she came across the river, the Rio Grande, and she hired a smuggler. And in order to get back to Irving, she would have to go through Brooks County.
Mm. Can we take a little step back just for a second? She had been living in the United States for roughly 10 years, had married, had children. What made her decide to go back? What made her decide to go back and try to get legal status the correct way, the legal way?
Well, I think she wanted to do things right. She wanted to live legally in the country and follow all of its laws. Her husband was a U.S. citizen. Her children were U.S. citizens. Many of her extended family also live in Texas, and they have residency, legal residency. So she, too, wanted to fix her documents. So she tried to do things right, you know, filing the paperwork and getting an immigration lawyer and all that. But when she got to San Salvador, the gang violence was so terrible that she realized there was no way she was going to be able to wait there 10 years or more.
So she didn't know before she went back that had happened in San Salvador.
I don't think they realized how bad it was. They know to an extent that it's bad. I mean, her mother told her, don't tell any of your neighbors or anybody that you have family in Texas, because right. the minute you do, they're going to target you for extortion, because they consider anybody who lives in the United States as being wealthy compared to living in El Salvador. So you're immediately a prime target for the gangs if they find out you have relatives in the U.S.
Okay, so she decides to come back. What happens next?
Well, she hires a smuggler, and they keep her in a halfway house down in Brownsville. And she pays half of the money to the smugglers. And in order to get through Brooks County, what the smugglers typically do is they'll drop people off several miles before the checkpoint, mm-hmm. and it'll be a 2 or 3 day hike to get around the checkpoint, and the terrain is very rugged. There's a lot of rattlesnakes. There's a lot of wild animals. It's very sandy there. Mm-hmm. They have about a foot of sand, and it's covered in a lot of stickers and cactus. So it's really tough to hike through that terrain. And I think a lot of people are, the smugglers don't tell them much about what the trip will be like. They have no idea. They're ill prepared. They may be out of shape. And anybody on the journey who falls ill or gets left behind for whatever, or who falls ill or falls asleep or wanders off, is going to be left behind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're on your own at that point. And when you're left on your own, your chances of surviving are very, very slim. So what happened with Excelina is that she became ill from heat stroke and started, you know, passing out, and they tried to help her, and it just got progressively worse, and so they left her there.
And how do we know that?
Well, there were two women who were traveling with her on the journey, and they called Excelina's parents. As soon as they got to Houston, they were all on their way to Houston, they called the next day, and they told them what had happened and that they had left her behind, but they didn't give her parents any information as exactly where they had left her. They just said it was near a ranch, near Falfurrias, and it's a vast area. There were a lot of ranches. So
is that because they didn't know the precise location?
Well, typically the guides keep that. The guides know where they're going, and they keep it a secret from the migrants, mm-hmm. because they don't want their popular corridors being given up to law enforcement. They don't want attention paid to the routes that they're taking. So they're very secretive about their location. And so the women weren't able to really get any information from the guides as to where they had left her.
And so where does the story end? Where are we now?
Well, the story focuses a lot on her mother Elsie's journey in her search for her daughter, and just how difficult it is for families who have lost their loved ones as they've tried to come across without documents. And this is a growing problem. I mean, all the way from our southern border states down to Central America, there are, you know, tens of thousands of missing people who have died on the journey, and nobody knows where they are. Their families are looking for them. There's been a lot of protests in Mexico of families and mothers looking for their missing loved ones. And, the southern part of the United States has the same issues. We have a lot of disappeared and missing people. And in Brooks County, what they've done for decades is they've just buried the bodies in paupers' graves and not done any DNA testing or kept record of their identification or anything, so that if the family came to Brooks County, they could find their loved one.
An absolute nightmare.
Yeah, they've just buried them in graves. And so there's now a project going on down there with Baylor University and Texas State, where they are exhuming the bodies and they're doing DNA testing pretty much on their own dime and trying to get the information into databases so that people down in Central America and Mexico can reconnect with their lost family members.
Well, this is a very important story. And I'm glad to hear that there are three parts left in the series, so we can hear about other aspects of this topic. I was wondering if you could give us at least a little clue of what we can expect from the remaining three stories.
Sure, yeah. Next Wednesday, we're going to focus on the landowners in Brooks County. It's mostly private ranches, and it's been a real crisis for these landowners who are finding these bodies on their properties. It's been a big change for them. So we're going to kind of explore that territory of what it's like for the landowners in Brooks County, where these deaths are happening.
Well, the story is Into the Wilderness, part one of a four-part series called Beyond the Border, made through a partnership with the Texas Observer and The Guardian. You can read it on texasobserver.org. Melissa, thanks for being on the show.
Sure, good to be here.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Dallas man Chris Scott served 13 years in prison before the work of students from the University of Texas at Arlington eventually led to his exoneration. Since then, Scott has formed a detective agency focusing on exoneration cases and is one of the subjects of an upcoming documentary called Freedom Fighters. In February, Scott met with Alonzo Hardy, the man who actually did the crime. Here to talk about this story is Chris Scott himself. Mr. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a little bit of background on your story?
Well, in 1997, I was tried, convicted, and sentenced to a life sentence in prison for capital murder for a crime I did not commit. And my case was basically the first non-DNA case in Dallas County history. One night I left home and picked up a friend, and they said, you know, there was a murder had happened, and it's like I like drove right into it. And from that day on, it was the worst nightmare of my life because I went to trial for capital murder and I got convicted of that crime. And they had no evidence, period. No murder weapon, no fingerprints, no positive ID, or nothing. They just had one person's statement saying I was the one that did it and ran with it. And the cold part about that is she really didn't identify me. The police identified her because when they walked her up to me, they pointed at me and said, this is the man that killed your husband. And she agreed to it. But this lady knows she had never laid eyes on me a day in her life. But that's just how the system was going back then. A lot of the witnesses was being coerced into saying things that wasn't true. And I spent 13 years of my life in prison for that crime. And eventually, my case got heard by the first African-American DA, which is Craig Watkins. He gave my case to this school of University of Texas in Arlington. And they worked it, and they was victorious. Because if they wouldn't, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now.
Well, the other thing that happened is that Alonzo Hardy, the man who actually committed the crime that you were imprisoned for, confessed, correct?
Yes, he did.
And I'm under the impression that this is a very rare event. You actually had the chance to meet with him and speak with him back in February. I was wondering if you could tell us how that opportunity came about.
Well, it was just, I wanted that to happen because I wanted some type of closure, and I wanted to ask him, basically, why did it take you so long to come back and confess to that crime? And when I first got out, I wasn't even really too much concerned about meeting Alonzo Hardy because I thought he was a coward for what he did because he committed that crime, and if you committed that crime, you should be able to do the time. So as like a year and a half passed, I started really thinking about it. Like, I should go and talk to this guy and ask him why it took him so long to confess. And this is like the first time this has ever happened. An exoneree was able to sit down and talk to the person he was went to prison for. And I went to see him, and it was kind of crazy because he had a lot of excuses about why he didn't come forward. And not one time did that guy apologize to me and tell me he was sorry for what I've been through. So I went down there and asked him why it took him so long to confess. And he said that I knew y'all didn't commit this crime. So it's nowhere in the world they have any evidence pointing towards y'all that'll get y'all convicted for that crime. So he said that's why he didn't come forward and confess, because he just didn't see the criminal justice system failing that way.
Right, he assumed there wasn't enough evidence to actually convict you.
Yeah, it was no evidence to convict me. No, it wasn't.
So there's a story about your meeting with Alonzo Hardy available on TexasObserver.org. And in that story, you say that the first thing you did was tell Hardy that you forgave him. That seems like a tremendously difficult thing to do. What made you do that?
Well, in order for me to have closure, I have to forgive that person. I can't forget, but I can forgive him. Because in aspect, I looked at it two ways. I say, this is the guy that took my life, and this is the guy that gave it back to me. Because if he wouldn't have never confessed to the crime, I would still be in prison right now. I wanted to at least thank him for that, because he really didn't have to do that. But he did, and that's the reason I'm here today.
Did you find the closure that you were looking for?
Yeah, I found the closure because of the simple fact I knew a guy like that wasn't just going to come forward and say he screwed up or that. I mean, you know, it was just, yeah, I'm glad I got the closure, because hearing him say the excuses he made just, you know, kind of like answered all the questions for me, that he was a coward. Now that I'm out here dressed in regular clothes and I'm seeing him dressed in those white clothes. So now it was a difference between him and me. And he made the statement that as us kind of being in a similar situation or the similar positions, and I had to tell him, no, the position you're in now is the position you made for yourself. I didn't ask to go to prison. I didn't commit that crime to go to prison. And just seeing myself being able to walk away, leaving him behind, and me going straight forward was enough closure for me.
Since your exoneration, you've formed a detective agency to free innocent people from prison. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what made you decide to do that and how that's going.
Well, it's going pretty good, really good. But I thought about it like I was laying up in my prison bed, and I always used to talk to guys in prison, their cases sounded similar to mine. And I was like, it can't be these many people on this unit, which is the COFIA unit, that saying they're innocent. Something has to be wrong. Some of these guys got to be lying. And some of the same guys I talked to got exonerated before I did. So what I started doing was like holding meetings in a day room, outside recreation. And I was asking the guys, what could we do to try to help the system stop having so many wrongful convictions? Or what could we do to try to help individuals that was in our position? And talk to them, we were coming up with certain scenarios. And I told them, I said, well, the first guy that gets exonerated out of this group I'm talking to, we need to form an organization to try to help guys in this position. And it seemed like I was the next person to get exonerated. So all of it kind of fell on my shoulders. And I didn't want to tell those guys I was going to get out and do something and don't stand on my word. And when I got out, it was so surprising to them because they was like, we never seen a non-DNA case get exonerated. That right there gave them the motivation, the hope, the confidence that it can happen for them. And once they start seeing me going to Austin, lobbying for new laws and bills to pass, and then when I started to have to renew hope, they kind of like put the icing on top of the cake. Because what I was doing was trying to help people in a position that I was once in. Because I know how I feel laying in that bed every night, tossing and turning, knowing you're there for another person's crime that they committed. So I had to do something, and I'm just glad I'm doing it now.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I do want to ask you about the documentary film, the upcoming film, Freedom Fighters. How do you feel about the documentary and your role within it? And what do you hope people who watch it will take away from it?
I just want people to understand how hard it is to get exonerated. I want to bring awareness to everybody, not only the exonerees, but people in this world in general, knowing that this happens all the time. And if we don't come together and fight against wrongful conviction, it'll remain in our society today. If we don't form some type of unity of trying to fight against it. The documentary is going great. It's following me when I investigate cases. It follows me out of town. It follows me inside of the prison cells to talk to the victims, get cases that I'm working on. And it's just a good thing for people to see, for me to open up my organization to see how hard it is to sit down and fight cases. And it's so crazy that you see how the judicial system screwed over a lot of individuals. I know it's hundreds, maybe even thousands, left in prison that's innocent.
Well, Mr. Scott, I thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
I appreciate you having me.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schulz. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.